Hello and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week I learned that your smartphone can zap your brain's power just by being around you. It doesn't even have to be on, you don't even have to be holding it, just its mere presence is making you dumber. Researchers from the University of Texas wanted to measure how well people could complete tasks when their smartphone was nearby. They corralled nearly 800 smartphone users for a variety of experiments that tested cognitive capacity. In one experiment, volunteers had to take a series of tests on a computer. The tests were geared to measure the brain's ability to hold and process data at any given time. To do well, a participant had to give her full and undivided concentration. Before sitting down to the computers, the volunteers were instructed to turn their phones to silent, and then they either had to place the phones on the desk face down, in their pocket or bag or whatever they had with them, or in a completely other room. And researchers found that the people who had their phones in another room significantly outperformed those with their phones at their desks. They even did better than those who had their phones in their pockets or bags, but not by as large a margin. In another experiment, the same computer test was used, but researchers were measuring self-reported smartphone dependence. And what they found was that when the self-proclaimed addicts had their phone nearby or in their pocket or bag, they performed worse on the test than their less dependent peers. But they did okay when the phone was in the other room. It didn't matter if the phone was on or off, face up or face down. The phone is still draining your cognitive abilities. There was actually a trend. The more noticeable a phone, the lower a person's ability to focus or perform tasks. It's not that you're consciously thinking about the phone, it's that part of your brain is actively working to not think about the phone, to not think about picking it up, looking at it, or using the phone. It's depleting your already limited cognitive resources. So save yourself, save your brain, put your phone far, far away. This week I learned that something funky happens to your brain when you blink. We blink a lot, somewhere between 20,000 and 30,000 times a day. That means your eyes essentially close for 10% of your waking hours. Initially, it was believed that the primary reason for blinking was to keep our corneas coated with tears. The thing is, we blink much more frequently than is necessary to sustain a healthy wetness on the eye. So scientists have recently been theorizing other purposes for blinking. A 2013 study found that during a blink, the brain does a mini reset, powering down for the briefest of moments some parts of the brain connected to vision and attention. And according to The Science of Us, which details a forthcoming study on the subject, blinking may alter our perception of time. In two experiments, researchers found that during a blink, time sped up. In the first study, volunteers were told to blink as researchers turned off the lights, only bringing the lights back on after the blink was over. So the participants spent a brief amount of time with their eyes open in the dark. And when researchers asked them to gauge how long they thought the darkness lasted, their answers suggested that time passes 2 to 4 times as fast during a blink than when their eyes were just open in the darkness. And these findings correlate with that older study, because if the parts of your brain that deal with vision and attention shut down, then your sense of time is going to be a little skewed. You know, when you pay attention to something, like think back to your days in high school and you're watching the clock and the minutes just seem to tick by oh so painfully. On the other hand, if you're not paying attention to the clock and are distracted by something, time can fly by. So if your brain isn't paying attention during the blink, time can have a way of speeding up. Researchers aren't quite sure why this happens, but they suspect it could be kind of similar to what happens to the brain during sleep. That your neural metabolism slows down and effectively takes a break for those 0.2 of a second. Mm-hmm. This week I learned that female vampire bats form surprisingly tight friendships. Now, we're not talking about traveling pants level girl bonding or a Sex and the City advice giving.
If I'd known the girl talk was going to be on lockdown, I wouldn't have flown 3,000 miles.
Vampire bats care for each other in their own bloodthirsty ways. They groom each other and regurgitate meals of blood. Vampire bats have relatively small families. Females produce only one baby bat, known as a pup, per year. But because with most animals, there's safety in numbers, bats form these really tight-knit colonies where multiple unrelated females regularly band together, sharing what's rightfully theirs with non-related bats. You see, the females are the major food donors to the vampire bat family. So to lose a mother or a daughter can gravely affect the family's survival. Vampire bats also really need that blood. If they miss two nightly meals in a row, they'll starve. Researchers from the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute recently discovered that unrelated friends are an important backup support when family members go missing. Before we start to get all warm and fuzzy about vampire bats, the motivation behind these girlfriends is pure evolutionary survival. Researchers studied a bat colony for 4 years, and they found that vampire bats that fed non-kin were creating a kind of insurance policy for later. It didn't always pay off immediately. If the generous vampire bat went hungry one night, the others didn't necessarily rush to her aid. But if they were close to starvation, the other female bats would step in, sharing blood meals. And in sharing, researchers saw a few things going on. Providing food for others not only strengthened non-relative relationships and increased the chances of being fed, but sharing also meant having a larger number of potential donors should one find herself in a desperate place. It's something researchers called social bet hedging. Female vampire bats are interested in quantity over quality friendships. It's something we humans may not necessarily relate to, since we gravitate towards smaller, tight-knit friend groups. And science does suggest that having a few strong social bonds is better than a greater number of weaker social ties. But this isn't the best policy for vampire bats and other animals that live in unpredictable social environments. If you think about it, on any given night when a predator can sweep half a bat's cohort away, or her closest relative switches to a different roost, or foraging comes up thin, it pays to have a wider and more robust social net of support than that one super close buddy, no matter how great she is to gab to. This week I learned that avocados were once purely ornamental. Hard to believe, considering Americans eat something like 7 pounds of avocados a year. But we had to be taught to eat and enjoy the once exotic fruit. And before that, I dare to think, we wouldn't have thought to consume those green buttery beauties at all. What's really cool is that today's bounty of trendy avocado toast and guac is thanks to a California mailman. But first, a quick history of avocados. Avocados grew wild in Mexico's highlands. Some seeds discovered there date back to 7,000 BC. The Aztecs were the ones to cultivate the avocados, selecting the larger ones and growing them for consumption. And the avocados would have offered a range of benefits for these Aboriginal farmers. The high fat content would have been good for their diet, and the fruit was incredibly convenient to harvest, still is, since it only starts to ripen when it's off the vine. I actually didn't realize this, but it's true. According to food scientists, that's likely because once the avocado is plucked, it is cut off from a hormone in the tree's leaves that prevents it from ripening. Eventually, the Europeans got a hold of them. English sailors in the 1700s were quite fond of avocados, and in fact, they may have been the ones to invent our most favorite brunch item. Because of the avocado's flesh being similar to the consistency of butter, these sailors would spread the avocado, which they called midshipman's butter, onto biscuits. Fast forward a little, and the avocado finally makes its way to the United States. It's first grown in Florida in 1833 as an ornamental plant. They call the fruit alligator pears. But it's the California horticulturalists who saw an opportunity to make the tasty avocado America's most beloved fruit. The first thing they did was change the name. The name the Aztecs had given the fruit was aguacate, which was the Aztec word for testicle. This naturally was a difficult sell for British Americans, so in 1915, a group of California farmers got together and invented their own name. Avocado was born, they informed the nation's dictionaries, and even organized the California Avocado Association. And this is where our mailman comes in. His name was Rudolph Haas, and sometime in the 1920s, Mr. Haas bought an avocado seed and planted it in his backyard. It went so well that he decided to try it again, but this time graft another variety of avocado onto it. The grafts didn't work as well as he hoped, and he was going to destroy the tree, but his kids talked him into saving it. The fruits, they said, were more flavorful than the avocados found already in the market. So the tree stuck around, and in 1935, Haas took out a patent on what he named the Haas avocado, which is the avocado you probably ate at brunch the other weekend. The Haas fruit is prolific. It comprises 95% of the more than 4 billion avocados that Americans eat every year, proving that we really just can't get enough. And that does it for this episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to read more about any of the facts I've mentioned, you can head on over to theweek.com/podcast, where you'll also find our 7-Minute Opinions and 7-Minute Explainers podcast. And as a thank you for listening to this episode, we'd like to offer you 4 risk-free issues of The Week magazine. To get those, visit theweek.com/4free. I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening.